afternoon. It is Monday the 10th of March in the year of our Lord 2014. The Queen is currently visiting the Abbey for Commonwealth Day. Mr. David Rampton, head of Busby's 1964, has very kindly agreed to be interviewed by me. I'm current Busby's upper shell, Nicholas Stone. Thank you very much for agreeing to do the interview. One thing I particularly wanted to ask about was, we might as well start off, which prep, the sort of linear timeline of this, which prep school did you come here from?
Well, my name's David Rampton, so I am the interviewee, and I went to a prep school called Bettshanger, which was long since closed, I think, which was in East Kent, and I came to Westminster in 1959 at the too young age of 12, because I didn't really start to appreciate what was going on for about 3 years. So I was here from 59 to 64, and I think I was head of Busby's or whatever it was called, that post, certainly in 64, but I can't remember whether it was one, two or three terms. Do you know?
I think in your entry in the ledger it says two terms.
Two terms, okay, fine.
I think there was considerable variation in that, wasn't there? How long people would do it for, wasn't there?
That I don't remember.
Right.
I don't remember. You'd have to check the ledgers if you can find them.
You said you came here when you were 12. Was there a lot of flexibility about what age people were?
I mean, the youngest anybody ever came was 12. It's just that I got in when I was 12, and it was actually a tactical error on the part of my parents, I think, because of that I was too young in all the classes and did O levels at a ridiculously young age and left here too young as well, and went to university too young. So it was an error all the way through.
I see. So was Busby's your first choice of house?
I remember nothing about choice. I was told I was going there, I should think, by my parents.
Right, I see. And is this a pleasing prospect?
Yes, I mean, I think I was pretty terrified, as unsurprisingly age 12, going from a school with about 100 people in it to a school with 400, where everybody was older. You know, it's a big fish into a whatever is it, little fish in a big pond, as opposed to the other way around.
Right. Actually, who was that? Your housemaster at that time? Was it Mr. Rawes?
Yes, Francis Rawes was the housemaster then, and he was, I think, for about my first 4 years, I should think, and then he was succeeded by Geoffrey Shepherd. They were both modern linguists, but of rather different characters.
I see. Did Mr. Rawes have a good reputation?
He must have had a good reputation. He became headmaster of not King's Canterbury, the other one in Canterbury. What's it called? St. Edmund's Canterbury. He left to become a headmaster elsewhere. He was slightly dry and slightly difficult sort of to relate to. He had several children, some of which came here, I think.
Right.
might even have taught here, or am I imagining that?
I don't know.
No, okay.
I've not come across that.
Okay.
But I see. So was he well liked among boys then?
Not. I think he was a slightly cold sort of bloke, and people were generally, I think, a bit neutral about him, dare one say. They weren't particularly warm. Quite in contrast to Geoffrey Shepherd, who was, I think, universally popular because he was approachable and he talked to you and he told you what he was feeling and thinking, which Mr. Rawes didn't.
I see. So
I'd just illustrate that on one occasion, which I remember very well, in about 1964, a boy leant out of the window of one of the dormitories right at the top of Busby's into the street outside, which is called, is it Great College Street? And had in his hand one of those sort of plastic or cardboard milk cartons. And threw it at, or dropped it on, or tried to drop it on the head of a passerby. And whether it actually hit the passerby, I don't know, but it splattered all over the road and gave the passerby a most awful shock. He was an old man. And we all thought that that individual would be singled out and, you know, castigated and possibly suspended and all the rest of it. But we were, in fact, the entire House was called into the sort of assembly hall at the on the ground floor. I don't know whether it's still there.
Yes.
And we were given a fantastic lecture about social responsibility, or talk about social responsibility. I sort of remember, think now about being excessively privileged and the responsibility that that brings to young people, and how we had individually and probably by inference collectively, we either had or were in danger of forgetting that. And that made a huge impression. It was made a huge impression on me, and I remembered it ever since. So he was that sort of bloke.
Right.
And I think people admired that and very much liked him for that. He wasn't without authority, but it was a different form of discipline that he imposed. He made you feel it yourself, I think.
Right. One thing that's changed quite a lot is the building of Busby's is in. At least I think it's changed.
I don't know whether it's changed, because I haven't been there since 1964. But when I was there, it was a very vertical building. There was a basement, and I can't remember what happened in that. Oh, yes, I can remember one thing happened. The Clarion office was in there, or the sort of room in which the Clarion was produced. And above that was a large room where most of us would assemble, I think, for things like evening prayers. There was a piano in it, and I think the junior part of the house did their prep in there. Tables, as far as I recall, sort of ranged around the outside. It was a sort of general common room, I think, for junior boys. And then ranged above that were sort of dormitories. And when I was there, quite a few of those were converted into single rooms for senior boys. And in the middle, these are all arranged around the lift, which were the ancient lift, which went up the middle, and which only, as far as I recall, senior boys were allowed to use.
No one's allowed to use it now.
Quite right, too. I think it's completely ludicrous that people should. It was a 5 or 6 storey building, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
The idea that, you know, people who should be in the prime of their lives should be allowed to use a lift to go up 6 storeys, I think was a bit ludicrous. We longed for it to be allowed to use the lift and loved it. And we often came down in the lift as well, but it was pretty ridiculous. So I at the top of the building, I think, is where the single rooms were put, some single rooms were put, and I can't remember how many there were, which the senior boys, a few of them anyway, had. I remember having a single room for much of my last year, I think.
Right, just... On the rooms, I know that from probably sometime before the early 80s, the head of house started having a particular room that goes on to be the head of house's room to this day. If he's a boy boarder, was that the case that there was a particular room for the head of the house then?
I don't know. I mean, I only remember my room vaguely. And that was in 1964, so clearly there was a single room for the head of house, and I think there were a few others for other people as well, for monitors, I think that's what they were called, and maybe one or two others too, but whether it was a single designated room, I can't tell you.
Was the head of house de facto a monitor? Or...
Yes, he was. He was the sort of chief monitor.
I see, and would have stood up school with...
You mean with that lot? When you mean the school monitor?
Yes, school monitor.
I thought you meant a house monitor. Can't remember. Can't remember at all. Don't know.
I see.
Don't know.
I see. So do you remember then a particular time of rebuilding? Do you say the remodelling of the single
rooms? There was some remodelling went on to make single rooms, which I don't think had been there when I arrived, I think. But I have no memories of it. I would guess it was done very sort of quickly and efficiently in the summer holidays or something. So, you know, some conversions were made so that... but I don't remember major building works during terms.
Right. I should just remember there's one mention made by a head of house from the 1950s, whose name escapes me at the moment, that in the room he had when he was head of house, which he presumed was the head of house's room on normally, there was a large birch rod in a glass case that was ceremonially belonged to the head of house. Is that something you remember from your...
No, I don't remember it. Never used it. There was no corporal punishment of any sort. And I don't remember that. I suspect it will have been taken, put somewhere, you know, out of reach of potentially naughty boys who would use it for purposes for which it wasn't designed, possibly. I don't know. Anyway, I don't remember it at all.
I see. That seems to have disappeared altogether now.
Is it?
But, that being the only evidence I've got for it.
Yeah.
The Clarion was produced in the basement. The
Clarion was produced in the basement in a very dark and dingy little room. At least it was obviously the articles were written elsewhere. I think maybe actually the only typewriter might have been in the basement, and one had to go down and type it out. And then it was cyclo-styled, I think was the term, off a sort of revolving ink drum. Made a terrible mess everywhere, and it was but it was much enjoyed. It was much enjoyed both by the readers and the writers. It was a very eclectic mix of stuff that appeared in it. I don't know. Have you still got any Clarions?
Yes, it comes out once a year.
But have you got any? We've
got the old ones from 1938 to the 59, and then a few that I think there's. There are sporadic issues after that until it peters out in about late 70s. It stopped altogether then, and I think it got resurrected in about the millennium.
Oh, did it?
Okay. As an annual production.
Because I vaguely recall it. I vaguely recall it coming out, if not every term, most terms. There was a chap called Fergus Chadwick who was the editor that I remember. Who was very well motivated and did it very well, wrote a lot of it himself, but he got sections on the Busby play, which you may come to, and sections on sports and so on, and a bit on music as well. So it was very enjoyable to read, not particularly scurrilous.
I see. What kind of circulation did it have?
Oh, only Busby's. So I think I would be surprised if more than 50 copies, maybe 100 were produced, I don't know. But
right.
Yeah, very local circulation.
I see. You mentioned the Busby play just now.
Yes.
How much do you remember about the roots of that, as well as what it was?
I have no idea when it started. It was going when I first arrived, and it was going when I left. The I don't know if it was the director or the producer. Anyway, the bloke responsible for it was always the housemaster, and they did very ambitious plays. The first one I was involved with was The Firstborn by Christopher Fry, which happened in about my second year, and we had when I was there. At least one actually very good actor. There was a chap called Carl McKenzie. I particularly remember The Firstborn because I had to be his daughter or his nephew, his niece, her niece. Well, she acted as a woman and I had to act as a woman, which I absolutely hated. And I also had to play the flute during it, and I think I almost deliberately got my arm broken in a football match on the afternoon of the first performance so that I actually didn't have to play the flute and a mate. In fact, a chap called Gellhorn, who was, I think, some relative of Martha Gellhorn, might even have been her son, played the flute off stage while I pretended with one hand, the other one being in plaster. But Carl McKenzie was a very good actor, and he acted in a series of plays thereafter. So I remember that one very well, and not with fond memories in the least. It was featured actually in the London Illustrated News. So if you get about 1960 copy of the Illustrated or the London Illustrated News, you will see pictures of it there. But they did other plays subsequently. I fortunately myself never acted again because I absolutely hated it. But the one I remember subsequently was The Strong Are Lonely by Hochfelder. And I've also got in my head a play called Night Must Fall. But when I looked up a synopsis the other day on Google, it seems to be mostly women. And I can't believe that a play was chosen that was mostly about women.
Perhaps avant-garde ideas.
I don't know. I can't remember anything about it, except that they say that's the synopsis I looked up. But it was a major event. It happened, I think, at the end of every play term. We used to have to practice or rehearse two or three times a week, I think, for the play term. So it was quite time-consuming as well. A lot of effort was taken with the lighting, a lot of effort with the music, and there was a chap called Jeremy Calton who was largely responsible for that, choosing the music and then organising it on an ancient, enormous tape recorders to switch it on at the right moments. And then it was well attended. I think, I can't remember whether he had one or two, I think we had two or three performances of it. And it, you know, people would come, obviously all the parents of Busby boys, and especially the actors, and whoever turns up to school plays these days would go to that.
So, nice. So was that up school then?
That was up school, yeah.
Right.
They had very good sets too. I mean, it was done, I think, very, very impressively, actually, especially for one house doing it.
Actually, were there other houses that did joint house plays then?
No, there was a school play about which I know nothing. But that was done, I think, annually. And there was also a Latin play, which was done in the garden of, or at the front of what used to be called Ashburnham House. Is it still called Ashburnham?
Yes.
That's where the library is on the first floor in Little Dean's Yard. I think it was done in the front there. But that was done on a school basis, not a house basis.
I think that might even have stopped altogether now, which is a great shame. But were there any other house societies then, apart from the Clarion and the house play?
Well, there might have been, but I just don't remember them. There were the house matches in each of the sports, which were engaged in with varying degrees of enthusiasm. I loved them, but not everybody did. I think there might have been a music society. We had quite a musical sort of group going through, but I can't remember any details if there was actually a formal music society.
Right. And there's a ledger that makes a ledger for the house debating. Is that happening very much that you remember?
I don't remember it at all. I never remember. This may be me just being a Philistine, but I never remember going to one. I don't remember anything about it.
Right. Coming back to a point you made before we started the recording, that a lot of heads of house who replied to my email have said is that they don't really remember whether or not there was a matron.
Yes. I'm afraid I don't remember a matron at all either, and I think we rather looked to the housemaster's wife to deal with us if we were ill, but I don't ever remember anybody particularly being ill. And I think if they got ill, they probably were sent home. But that's confabulation to an extent. I certainly don't remember a matron here, whereas I do remember a matron at my previous school very well. You know, she played a leading role in one way or another in keeping the place going. But I don't remember one at all at Busby's.
Right. Okay. Just a brief word further about the house ledgers. I remember you said that you did remember having to write in one. Was this a difficult task?
It was a chore. I thought it was at the end of. You told me it's two terms that I was head of house. At the end of each term, one had to sit down and write a few pages on the events of that term that had occurred in the house. And I'm not a very sort of
particularly good writer or humorous or anything. I don't think it was meant to be humorous. It was meant to be a rather serious, actually rather weary record, which might be interesting now, but it just seemed rather... I did it, but I didn't particularly enjoy doing it. What I did quite enjoy doing was looking back at previous entries in the House Ledger, and particularly, you know, going back to, I think, the late 40s when Wedgie Benn was head of House. That was quite amusing reading what he'd written.
We can't go into that too far because it's not yet... I don't think that's yet in the public domain, but...
Well, I don't know whether any of the ledgers are. They're probably not, are they? They were meant to be confidential, from what I recall. And indeed, one of the privileges of being head of house was that you could get at the ledger, and you could actually read it, what had been written before. And as far as I recall, nobody else did. Maybe the house... I guess the house master might.
Right. A more general point, do you help... Were there any ways that you perceived that the school was changing, particularly while you were there, or changes that looking back seem to have happened while you were there?
No, I don't. It always seemed to be quite a modern school by comparison with other schools that I knew of, and I think that was partly because it was in central London. You weren't locked away with 300 other boys in the middle of the countryside for 13 weeks at a time. We all escaped all the time. You know, after 4:30, you could wander. In those days, I don't know whether you still can, but you could disappear off into London. You had to say where you were going, and you had to sign back in, as far as I recall. But you could go to concerts, you could go to art galleries, you could not officially go to the pub, but people did. And in that way, it seemed to be much less restrictive than equivalent institutions at that time were out in the country. But whether it changed within itself much during that time, I don't think it did. The headmaster was John Carlton, and I think he was still headmaster, I think he was, for a year or two at least after I left. And then I think it might have begun, begun to change. I think one of the changes will have been that to some extent it's taking in boys and girls, obviously, and that's a major change since then, of a different sort of background, than it did, because I think, relatively speaking, it's probably become even more expensive and unaffordable than it was then, but I can't defend that position. It's just a feeling I have.
Right. Well, probably has quite a lot behind it. But has any other general comments or interesting facts that? That you think ought to go down on record?
No, I don't think so. I suppose I'll put this on record. I don't mind it's on record. I did feel after I left that even though we were in the middle of London, and even though we got lectures or talks from very good ones, from like the one I mentioned that Geoffrey Shepherd gave us, about social responsibility and so on, we were actually desperately overprivileged and totally unaware of the real world. And if, like I did, you then went on to, and in those days we had closed scholarships and closed exhibitions to, I went to Christchurch on a closed thing. I didn't get in touch with the real world for about 10 years after I'd left school. And I had no experience of the real world, real people. I don't mean that everybody's real, but you know what I mean. It was such a sheltered, protected, unthreatening environment that, it, in that sense, it didn't prepare you for life outside, the protected professions. But that's true of, I think, probably all public schools, whatever we call them, private schools. But that's what I regret about having been here, that it, you know, it was, took me so long to come in contact with the real world. And I, the reason I've come in contact is that I'm a doctor and I've worked in the East End since 1983. And that's the first time I actually, that's more than 10 years, that's almost 20 years after I left school. So a lot of learning had to be done very quickly.
I see, and you...
Which you weren't given any, you weren't given any of that. I you know, I think that education ought to do more than just, it was terribly good teaching, really good teaching, and, you know, I hugely enjoyed it at the time, but I just regret a bit that we weren't a bit more exposed to the outside world, despite being in the middle of London. Now, you may say, how you do that? Well, we're not going to go on about that now, but...
I know it's an interesting point.
Yeah. And maybe it is done more now. You know, maybe you do link up when you have social responsibilities outside, and they certainly do in some medical schools, for example, their responsibility. Some of them put students into blocks of flats where they're housed free on the condition that they look after an old person in the same block of flats, you know, make sure that person's all right at all. For example, it's a very superficial example, but there are ways I think you can relate to the community around.
Yeah, just as a slightly more general point still, is there any particular members of staff or colleagues from your time there that you either kept in touch with or had particularly strong memories of, but
I haven't kept up with any masters. Some of them I hugely admired, some of them I didn't, but that's true, you know, of any, and you sometimes learn as much from the masters you think are absolutely useless, and that's true in my medical life as well. You know, the you can be taught how not to do things as well as you can be taught how to do things. And, but some of the teaching here was fantastic, and, you know, I would never regret any of that.
You don't have to mention names if you don't want to, but any particular characters?
Well, okay, fantastic characters. One fantastic character, as you know, was David Hepburn Scott, who had such a sad end, but he was a hugely well-motivated, amazingly sort of charismatic teacher with an extraordinary voice, which I don't know whether you've ever heard, you know, sort of imitations of it, but he did have an extraordinary voice and extraordinary gestures, but he was highly memorable, and when you sat in the lesson, there was no question of sort of drifting off to sleep. There were a couple of teachers, and I won't mention their names, in the science subjects that I did, who were the most depressing teachers, and you just couldn't stay awake because they spoke in a monotone, and they just sort of drifted through the topic of the hour or three quarters of an hour, whatever it was. There was one absolutely horrible man, I thought, because the year I arrived, or the year after I arrived, was the quattercentenary, and the Queen, by coincidence, visited and was shown around the school. And I had to show, aged, I think I was 12 or 13, and I was a year behind, and I hadn't a clue what was going on. I'd just been plonked in there, because not only was I a year younger, but I was wasn't in the bottom of the two, I was in the second bottom class. So I didn't know anything what had gone in the first year, so I was, you know, a year behind and a year too young. And I had to demonstrate to the Queen how to do a titration. Can you imagine? I don't know what your subject is. Well, exactly. I hadn't a clue what a titration... You know, I had to explain to her what it was, and I was terribly nervous, quite naturally, and I had to talk to her for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then at the end of the afternoon, this man, whose name I won't mention, but he was the chemistry master, and you could probably work it out, came up to me and said, the Queen won't have had a clue what you were talking about. That was the most appalling presentation I've ever heard, or words to that effect. And, you know, that's not good teaching. And I remember that ever since as actually hugely educational, how not to teach.
Right.
And he himself was the most boring, sort of bitter teacher and bitter and boring man that I've ever... Well, one of the most boring. And you can see I've got a little bit of a chip about him as well as a result of that experience. But most of them were really good. Lots of good teachers.
and enthusiastic and, you know, inspiring. There were some hilarious events. When I was here, there were a couple of... I don't know how long you want me to go on for or not.
Oh, it's not as long
as... long as I can be bothered. There was a chap called... There was two boys, one called Gordon Waller and the other one called Peter Asher. I don't know whether you've read about them in your readings. Anyway, one was in Liddell's and one was in... I can't remember what the other might have... anyway. And they became a pop group. And they were called Peter and Gordon. And they got... To, while they were still at school or in their last year, I think, had a number one in the hits, in the pop charts. Peter Asher's sister was... What's that Asher woman called about my age now? Jane Asher, yes. Okay. Who was a sort of pop star or fashion person or... Something like that. And their father was a very good psychiatrist.
There's just one final thing, which I probably ought to have asked earlier. You said that, that you coming back recently, you found that the character is more or less unchanged.
Well, it's terribly superficial. Right. I was only back for one evening. I might have come twice, actually, but I certainly remember that evening, which was the last time I came, one evening at a formal dinner. Quite difficult for it to show a different character, but it didn't seem to change. And it partly, of course, if you haven't been for 20 years, which I probably hadn't, or 30 years then, you come and the building is exactly the same, then you're so impressed by being in the same building. I think it's quite difficult to detect a change in character because you're sort of imploded by the sensation of this is where I used to eat Weetabix and cook toast every morning for breakfast, which is what we did, and probably supper too.
Was there very much sense of difference between Busby's as you knew it and Busby's as it had been in the decades just before that? Or?
No, I don't think, not that I know about. I think there was a sense that Busby's was quite different from some of the other houses, in that I think we sort of felt that Grant's was rather sort of posh and up itself, if it's possible to be posh and up itself in a posh and up itself place, if you see what I mean. Whereas Busby's was rather more down to earth and sort of normal seeming. But so in other words, we distinguished between ourselves and Grant's a little bit, and ourselves and Rigo's, and a bit ourselves and Liddell's as well, who were a bit more sort of eccentric. They had an eccentric housemaster, Mr. Liddell. Sorry?
It's odd how little things change. Those stereotypes could be now.
Could they? Well, maybe, in fact, the character does, you know, not change much. And I mean, I always slightly felt that we were sort of potentially a little bit dull and ordinary and not remarkable, because the building itself wasn't terribly special. It wasn't a beautiful sort of building that Grant's is, for example. Hmm. And I think that was quite good for us.
Well, thank you very much.
Right.
It's been... great pleasure hearing this. I hope it will be of. Hope you've got some enjoyment out of remembering this.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. So long as you don't use it in improper places or in improper words. And I hope I haven't been too scurrilous.